got a Bible, turn with me to Exodus chapter 17. If you are just visiting this morning, here's the quick rundown. We've met Israel, this slave people in Egypt. We've watched them go through 10 plagues. We've come through the moment of Passover. We've watched them be delivered through the Red Sea being parted. We've journeyed with them into the early stages of the wilderness. And we meet up with them now in chapter 17 on the backside of God having just miraculously provided for them water from a rock, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 10. That was Jesus. He was there, and he's still here for us today. And we pick up the story now this morning in chapter 17, verse 8, and we're going to try to get all the way through the end of chapter 18, basically looking at three scenes. Now, every time I come to the Exodus over the last few weeks, I've had a thought go through my head. Now, kind of hang with me so you see what the parallel is all about. I think of the early years of my marriage. Now, let me explain. You know, it was like slavery in Egypt. No, not at all. It was great. It was not like it in that sense. But in the early years, we were married at 20, so we're pretty young, and sort of it was like get married, move out, become adults, all in one sort of fell swoop. It was pretty exciting and chaotic. Add on top of that, we were both in school, so we were, you know, doing the whole literally trying to figure out how you live on love and craft dinner and other cheap forms of pasta, all those good things. There's certain things that stand out to me from those years. One is the various places we lived, sort of like the cheapest sort of rental accommodation you could find. I remember one where the smells coming from the upstairs were so unusual that we actually duct taped over all the vents. We didn't have heat, but nor did we have to smell something strange. There was the other one. You'll probably have to explain this one to people afterwards when they tell this story. Actually, the first place we lived, right? You know, get back from our honeymoon, move into the first suite. We were both working, and our landlord decided to come down into our suite and have a shower one day, thinking we were both gone, not knowing that it was actually a day off for Linda and she was sleeping in. So you can imagine the surprise of waking up to the sound of someone showering next door. Lots of things, right? And years later, you laugh. I mean, at the time, it wasn't super funny. But years later, you look back, you chuckle. But one of the things, in all honesty, that I remember in those early years was getting to eat whatever you want. And for us, for me, that meant, it's like, why would you eat vegetables? Your entire life, you've grown up with your mama saying you really should eat your vegetables, and so you eat your vegetables. It was freedom. It's like, for the first time in my life, there's no one saying, eat your vegetables. And so, we just sort of, for a while, didn't eat vegetables until someone gave us some free ones. That's a whole other story. It's amazing what you'll eat when it's free. Now, what does that have to do with the Exodus? I know you're wondering, so I'm still not tracking with Exodus. Here's, for me, what it has to do with Exodus. See, those early years of marriage were sort of figuring out, how do you live? With sort of this newfound freedom. You're out on your own, and you're adults, and you're married, and all these. And you navigate it, you slowly sort it out, and eventually I start eating, you know, vegetables again. You realize, actually, they do, you know, there's wisdom in that. Mom wasn't wrong for all those years. You eventually sort out life. And as I think of the Israelites coming out of Egypt, that's the thought that keeps going through my head, is what did it look like for these people? I mean, this is a nation people, roughly 3 million or so people, where very likely there was not a man or woman or grandparent who had ever tasted freedom. Generations of people born, lived, died as slaves. No one ever had to think of, what do I do when I grow up? No one had to think of, what course do I take? No one had to think of any of those things. You didn't have to think of when you got up and when you went to bed, because there was someone to tell you when to do all those things. And then one day, you went from that to freedom. God said, I'm going to make sure my people are free. And you walked through the Red Sea, and on the other side of the Red Sea, one morning you woke up. In my mind's eye, you probably woke up at the same time you'd woken up every day of your life, because isn't that how we are? You get into the pattern. But that morning you woke up and there wasn't a brick to be made. There wasn't a crop to be harvested. There was just freedom. Now, I would guess there was joy, there was singing and celebration, but I wonder to myself, what did they do next? I mean, the only model they had of what it looked like to live as free people were the Egyptians, a nation that had built itself and founded itself on things like decadence and superstition and an ethic that sort of goes along the might makes right kind of lines. That's the only model they had ever seen of what a free people looks like. And all of a sudden, they wake up one morning on the other side of the Red Sea, knowing we are free. But what do free people do next? There was a study done. Actually, it's a heartbreaking study in a book written by a man named Jim Downs, a university professor in the States, who studied the next chapter after the emancipation of slaves, a chapter that's not talked about much. We know slavery was an evil thing, and so we know the end of it is a good thing, but not many of us know what happened the next day when the people who were formerly enslaved were now free. And he tells the tragic story over the next 5 years, roughly a quarter of all the men, women, and children who had been in slavery would be dead. Now, I'm not saying that should mean they go back to slavery. Of course not. And there was all sorts of other factors mixed into that. Oppression continued well beyond the end of slavery. But it tells us that just because you are free doesn't necessarily mean you know how to live as free people. And that's, I think, where we come to this morning in the story of Exodus. God essentially teaching his people, how do you live as a free person? He's going to do it, I think, through three scenes we come to this morning that really answer three questions. So I'll give you the questions, and then we're going to walk through the story. Here's the three questions. Number one, how do we protect ourselves? What does that look like as a free person? Because one of the things Israel did not have to worry about for all those years as slaves was the issue of protection. You had the Egyptians to protect you. I'm not saying it's a good thing at all. But they were a valuable commodity to the Egyptians. They protected them to keep them. But now on the other side of the Red Sea, how do a free people protect themselves? The second question is this: how do we treat people around us? Because for years and generations, that was mandated. It was enforced. But now on the other side of that sea, with liberty and freedom, how do you treat people who are different than you? And then lastly, and this is really just the first installment on this last question that really we'll be picking up through essentially the rest of the story of Exodus, is how do we live to please God? When we have freedom and can do essentially whatever we want, how do we live? What does it look like to live in such a way to please God? The first question comes, I think, from chapter 17, verse 8. So let me pick up and read you this small little scene. We talked about it a couple months ago. Here it is again. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Just so you know, Amalek, when it's referring to the Amalekites, this is a race, a tribe of people that are actually related to the Israelites. Jacob and Esau, if you remember the Bible story, you've got two brothers. Jacob would give birth to what becomes Israel. Esau will give birth to what becomes the Amalekites. So it's not far back that the Amalekites are part of the family woven in. And now we meet them again here in the wilderness. They come, and Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us. Go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a memorial in a book. Recite it in the ear of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." It's a strange sort of scene. Strange because we haven't seen Israel in a battle scene yet. Up to this point, God has been the one to fight all the battles for them. The Egyptians chase, but God deals with it. This is the first time there'll be real swords drawn. This is the first time there'll be dust and blood spilled. This is the first time Israel will come to the point of a conflict. Now, there's not much detail of what the conflict's all about. We know because Numbers and Deuteronomy reflects back on this moment, talks about how the Amalekites come and begin to pick off the weak, the stragglers behind this long train of a nation traveling through the wilderness. We see the brutality. Historians tell us that the one thing that the Amalekites are remembered for is the domestication of camels. That's their claim to fame, which sort of seems funny until you realize they did it as a military maneuver. They were the only people who could come out of nowhere, out of the desert, where no one else could survive. They would come with their camels out of the desert and wreak havoc on unsuspecting people. The Midianites picked it up from the Amalekites. We're coming to them in a little bit. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the Amalekites arrive and begin to destroy this newly freed people. And in this moment, in this scene, we learn an answer to this question: how will they protect themselves? What's interesting about the scene is there's almost no detail of what takes place down in the valley. Did you catch how sparse it is? It basically amounts to Moses going to Joshua and saying, choose some men. Don't think there's so many options that he's got to select from so many good options. Read it the way it's meant to be, which is there's virtually no good options, so you're going to have to kind of scrounge someone together. And by the way, you've got one day. Form an army in one day. Prepare them for battle, because tomorrow you will fight. Aside from that, we don't see much of what goes down in the valley. Instead, all eyes get focused on something happening up on a hill, where Moses says, tomorrow I'll go up to the hill. I'm going to take God's staff, and I'm going to raise my arms. Now, when we talked about this a while ago, I probably, made light of it too much, but I'm not sure whose idea this was, because to raise your arms and say, as long as I raise my arms, we'll win. I mean, you know how hard it is to keep your arms held up high, right? It's not an easy thing, but this is what Moses comes up with. But I would also want you to understand that this is the posture of prayer. If you go through the story of Exodus so far, places like chapter 9 and earlier, when Moses raises his hands to heaven, essentially what he's doing is he's praying to God. So now you can picture the scene. You've got Joshua and those who are chosen down in a valley. You've got Moses, some 80 years old, up on a hilltop, arms outstretched to heaven, staff in his hand, praying to God. And then we're told how the story goes. Eventually his arms get weak, and the Israelites who were prevailing, which just means not winning, it actually means they were strengthened. Isn't that interesting? What it should read is, as long as his hands were in the air, they were strengthened and they won. When his arms dropped, it should read, in my understanding anyway, that they were no longer strengthened, and so the Amalekites won. But isn't it interesting, the language? His arms come down, the Amalekites are strengthened. See, there's more than one side in this equation. There's always more than one side. We have God who fights for us, and there is an enemy fighting against us. We see that so plainly in places like Ephesians. But as long as Moses' hands are held up, there is strengthening and prevailing. And as his arms get tired, two men, Aaron and Hur, probably roughly age 85 and 90, come along and hold. I love that scene. Every time I think of that scene, it encourages me to say to those of you who are in that chapter of life, don't ever give up in serving God. Critical role. You see, had Moses' arms not stayed lifted up to heaven, had those prayers not continued, Joshua down in the valley was going to lose. I can prove it to you, because later the Israelites will fight the Amalekites one more time, this time without the help of God, and they will be thoroughly beat. You see, it's not that the Israelites were strong enough to compete, it's that God was strong enough to conquer. And God teaches us in this story that He will be the one to protect. What's the answer to who will protect us as free people? The answer is God will. And our greatest, most important activity then becomes prayer. Not swinging the sword, but going to God in prayer. The story ends with a couple interesting little notes in verse 14 and 15. The first one is this: write this down. This is the first time anything's been written. This is the first commanded moment where God says, I want something written right now, what happened here. And oh, by the way, Moses, make sure Joshua hears it. Isn't that an interesting little side note? It's not just as sort of gentle as what my translation says. It says, recite it in the ears of Joshua. No, it's way more forceful than that. It is, you make sure whatever else happens, that Joshua knows what happened in that valley and that he understands it was not the strength of his sword that won. It was the strength of the God who was being prayed to. It wasn't about arms. It wasn't about staffs. It was about a God who acted. Who protects a newly freed people? God does. I'm guessing there's probably two reasons that Joshua is told specifically. One is he will go on to lead this people. He needs to be taught this lesson loud and clear. Joshua, if you remember one thing, remember, it's God who gives victory, not you. I think the second reason probably he's singled out is he was the one down in the valley. If anyone was going to mistakenly think he won the war, I think he's the prime candidate. So Moses, you make sure Joshua understands. No matter how valiantly and skillfully he fought, the victory was not his, the victory was God's. The last thing we're told there is that Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner. Now, a banner is sort of a military insignia. If you've seen sort of, you know, old knight in shining armors, you maybe seen the poles with the fancy flags. It's not quite an accurate picture for this time in history. At this point in history, pretty much all they were was a pole, just a pole being held up that had some sort of indication which side you were on so that people could rally to this pole. It could move around. The troops would follow the pole. In other words, the pole represented the strength of the army, the king of the army, the leadership of the army. And Moses is saying, here's what we learn as the people of God. God is the strength of this army. He's the leader, the rallying point, and the victor. It's interesting, by the time we come to Deuteronomy 20, as the people of Israel are about to come into the promised land, they get specific instructions from God of how they are to do battle. You can go read it sometime. It's actually kind of interesting to just think through the chapter. Let me summarize some of the lessons that come out of it. Number one, there is to be no standing army. Can you imagine a nation at this time in history that is not permitted to have a standing army? They're just all normal, ordinary people. They're all amateurs. There's no drilling, no training. Why? Because God's going to protect them. They're all volunteers. No one will get paid a penny in this army. Why? Because God's going to win the victory. There is no personal plunder allowed. Every other nation goes to war to gain something, and Israel is not allowed a single item. They are not allowed to attack other than for the conquest of the land God's given to them and to protect it. You're never supposed to hear a story of the army of Israel going to war to expand their kingdom as the other nations did. Because God was going to be the one. They were only to go to war at God's command. And that command would only be issued through a prophet. Can you imagine being the king of this nation? You've been put in as a leader and you no longer have permission to lead this nation to war. Only God would do it. And oh, by the way, you also read the other instructions in Deuteronomy 20. Things like, you know, if you planted a vineyard, you don't have to go to war. Stay home and watch it grow. If you built a house, you don't have to go to war. Stay home and enjoy this. You've been married, you don't have to go to war. Stay home. If you're a little bit afraid, you don't have to go to war. Stay home. I mean, the instruction is, it's incredible. And all of it teaches us this simple lesson. God will be the one who will protect his people. You afraid of anything right now? You have any obstacles against you? God is the one who protects you. It was true 3,500 years ago and remains true to this very day. Second lesson, how do we relate to others? Well, this one should be obvious, right? After chapter 17, the lesson should be, when we come across someone who's different than us, Moses goes on the hill and prays, we grab our swords and kill them. I mean, there's how we ought to relate to everyone around us. Except that's not what chapter 18 shows us at all. Chapter 18 begins this way. Jethro, the priest of Midian, stop for a second. because you probably need to understand or be reminded who the Midianites were. If you go all the way back to Genesis, again, the Midianites are not a new group. They are the offspring of Abraham. Abraham has a few wives. After Sarah dies, he takes another wife. She has six sons. Midian is son number four. He's the son who gets booted out in chapter 25 because Abraham is trying to protect things for Isaac. Midian has a very long history of not liking the offspring of Israel. Midian will be the ones that keep showing up and keep fighting over and over, all the way into the story of Gideon many years later. Midian and the Amalekites actually are very closely related and allied, interesting enough, through this time in history. And what I think we should expect is chapter 18. Jethro, the priest of Midian, shows up. Chapter 2 tells us he's not just a priest. He's the high priest. He is the leader of the religion of the Midianites, who are people who do not like the Israelites. Verse 2 should be, and so Moses goes up on the hillside, says to Joshua, we're back on, gather the guys again. There's going to be a war. We got to kill Jethro, and then we're going to track down all of his family and anyone connected with him. Let's get rid of them too. And there should be how we would expect them to relate to those different than them. That's not how the chapter goes. Find out that Jethro, we're reminded, is Moses' father-in-law. We won't make any father-in-law jokes. My father-in-law was here last Sunday. And he had heard, make note of this, of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and how the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. Just notice that, because what that tells us is right at the start, he's coming to see Moses, and he's already heard all of it. There is nothing new to be told. He knows every story. He knows the plagues. He knows the Red Sea. He knows God's deliverance. He knows the water from the rock. He knows all of it. Now, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he sent her home, along with her two sons. The name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the name of the other, Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. In other words, Moses names his kids in such a way that it recalls what God has done. The first one, I was a foreigner in a foreign land. The second one, God has helped me. See how kind of the two big chapters of Moses' life. So he names his kids that way. Then verse 5, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. And when he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and your two sons with her. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other the welfare and went into the tent. Then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Is this new news to Jethro? No. He already knew all this stuff. But notice he doesn't say to Moses, Moses, you can save your breath, I already know the story. He doesn't. He lets Moses tell the story again. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel, and that he delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who's delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of Pharaoh, for he's delivered his people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people. And Jethro, Moses, and father-in-law brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Isn't it interesting that then we read a little story like that, pretty much every question I've got doesn't get answered. I'm kind of going, well, why was Zipporah off back with her father-in-law? Last time we met her, she was with Moses on her way to Egypt. Why did that happen? And I wonder what Moses' kids are like. I wonder why Moses doesn't even seem to greet her or the kids. What's going on within this family? And I wonder, and I wonder, and I wonder. We're told nothing of that. All we're told is of a whole separate little scene with a Midianite who is the chief priest of a foreign religion and Moses coming out to give testimony to who God is. As far as I can tell, this is the first moment in all of Scripture where someone shares the good news. Like, not the good news that we would normally talk about. When we say the good news, usually we're talking about Jesus, his death on the cross, how that deals with our problem of sin. But he's sharing, Moses is, the good news of who God is and what God has done for him. This is the first moment. And beyond that, it's the first moment that I can think of where actually someone who is not a follower of God, Yahweh, hears the good news, and you see what happens? He says, now I know. Not only do I know, I'm going to now gather with those who follow God, and I'm going to bring sacrifices, and I'm going to worship a God who yesterday I didn't worship. Yesterday I worshiped a different God, the God of the Midianites. In fact, not only did I worship him, I led others in the worship of him. Now, everything's changed. What does that mean for us? What does that mean for Israel? I think it means this, that God intended his people to be a missionary people. How do we relate to people who are different? Notice Moses doesn't say, quick, get a sword, there's a Midianite. Instead, he does things totally different. Let me just point out a couple of things that we might not have realized are sort of odd details of the story. The first one is Moses should have never left his tent. We're in a very honor-driven society. So here's how it should have gone. Moses, the leader of a nation of 3 million freed people, sort of sat in his tent, and his father-in-law, a foreigner with a foreign religion, should have come and basically groveled before him and bowed down and prostrated himself. And Moses, maybe if he was in a gracious mood, should have said to his father-in-law, arise. Instead, do you hear what happened? Moses gets up and leaves his tent. And he goes to Jethro, and he bows down to him, and he honors him, and he kisses him. So if you're going to share the good news of someone, you have to make sure you practice your bowing and your kissing. I'm kidding. But what you do need to do is take a note from this of how Moses honored someone who thought very differently. He didn't look to expose all the errors, all the wrongness of what Jethro believed. Instead, he just shared who God was and what he'd done. That's your job. To this day, it remains our purpose that Jesus gave us. In fact, you look at the early church in Acts, that's all they were doing. We're just going to tell the good news of who Jesus is. That's all we know to do. Same thing all the way back at this scene. We're just going to tell who God is and what he's done. We'll leave the rest up to him. God works in an incredible way because Jethro gets it. He already knew the details of the story. It's not that the story is new. When we read Jethro saying, now I know, it's not formerly I didn't know information, now I know information. He's saying, now I've realized the truth of this information. The God I've heard of is the only true God. And the language there is actually interesting. I think it's a great description of someone coming to understand who God is. The language is a language of joy. In fact, I think it's the first time in Scripture where a word that is a joy-type word shows up. What Jethro describes is in his heart, he has joy at what he comes to know about God. Isn't that great? I hope when you hear the gospel, you have joy. It's the right response to what God has done. So, we've learned a couple things. Who protects this people? God does. How do we relate to others who are different than us? Well, we honor them, but we also share the truth. Notice Moses doesn't stop short. He doesn't just bow down and kiss his father-in-law and say welcome and, you know, all those sort of things. He also makes sure he shares with him what is true. That's what we should do as well. Honor and share truth. Isn't it interesting that when Paul starts speaking of this in Ephesians 4, remember what things he pulls together? Grace and truth. Pulls them together and says, there's how we as followers of Jesus will carry out our mission. Leaves us with one last question and not much time to deal with it. So let's just quickly consider one last scene. Verse 13. The next day, Moses sat to judge the people. The people stood around Moses from morning till evening. When Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is it that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and all the people stand around you from morning till evening? And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me and I decide between one person and another. And I make them know the statutes of God and his laws. Picture the scene. Now we've got 3 million people. It's like a Disney ride gone horribly wrong. 3 million people standing in a line. What are they coming to Moses for? They're coming to inquire of God. In other words, translated in the way we might speak of it, when we say, I wonder what God's will is for my life. I wonder what spouse he would want me to marry. I wonder what school he would want me to go to. I wonder what job he would want me to take. I wonder if he'd want me to buy that home or do this or... That's us seeking the will and plan of God, right? We go to God in prayer over those things. What we're told now is the entire nation is coming to Moses. He sits in a chair. They line up from morning to night. He teaches them the statutes of God, and then he applies it to what God's will is for their life. And Jethro watches all this and comes to Moses. I don't know the tone of voice or exactly how he asked it, but he comes to Moses and says, Moses, what exactly are you doing here? And Moses explains it all. I think Moses probably is fairly proud. He's like, look what I'm doing. I'm delivering the statutes of God. This is a good thing, right? Listen to what Jethro describes. Listen to his take on it. Verse 17. What you are doing is not good. Now, it's not good in the sense that delivering the statutes of God and talking to people about the will of God is somehow a bad thing to do. He's not saying that part's not good. What he's speaking of is the fact that there is a lineup of people, as far as the eye can see, who are never going to have the opportunity to get to Moses to answer their question. Jethro looks and just says, this can't be the way this happens. Now, I want to point out two things quickly in this scene of how we live now to please God. One that has to do with the story, one that steps back and looks at it. So, Jethro's answer, he says, it's not good. And then he proposes a new way. He says, Moses, here's the quick version. He says, why don't you appoint people? You know, for every, 50 get a person, 100 get a person, 1,000, you appoint people. If you do the math, it means out of every million people, Moses is supposed to appoint about 131,000 people to help him. In other words, the thought of one man doing this for a nation of 3 million people meant that he was doing the work of 400,000 people. Jethro says, this just isn't good. We need to do this differently. Now, here's the particular lesson. We need to make sure that as God's people, when we serve in roles of leadership, whether it's us as pastors, and I've been looking at myself lots this week in the mirror over this story, whether it's you in your small group or ministry that you're leading, that we don't ever put ourselves in a spot where we can't share the ministry. God says, that's just not good. That's not how it's designed. In fact, by the New Testament, the very qualifications that Moses and Jethro talk through here in verse 20, 21, he talks about, appoint men who fear the Lord, who are trustworthy, and who are not greedy. You go read the discussion in Titus and 1 Timothy about leaders in the church. It's the same qualities. God hasn't changed. He's still after men and women who will lead with godliness and integrity, with trustworthiness, not looking to say, how can I gain? How can I line my pockets in all this? That's the particular lesson. That's how we live. We trust God and we share ministry. But there's one other principle that I see here that I wonder about. Because here's, I think, what would have gone, if I'm going to be completely honest with you, if I'm in Moses' shoes, and my chief priest, Midianite father-in-law, who just showed up at the scene, comes to me and says, after I've led 3 million people through the wilderness out of Egypt, I put my life on the line for this mission. He wasn't there all that time. He's just showing up now. He was safe back home all that time. And now he swoops in and starts throwing criticism at what I'm doing. You put yourself in that spot. Maybe you've been there a little in a smaller version. You're leading something. You're doing your best. And someone comes in and says, oh, by the way, what you're doing, it's really not that good. You go, but I put my heart and soul into this thing. And someone just goes, yep, not good. Here's what I think I might have said, or at least would have gone through my head if I was Moses. Who do you think you are to come in, enter my tent after I've honored you? You've been a follower of God all of like 12 hours. And now you think you can lecture me and tell me how to do this better than I can? I'm the one that hears from God. See this staff? It's in my hand, not yours. See these people? They follow me, not you. Instead, let me tell you what Moses says. Verse 24. So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all he said. Not a question, not a protest, Not a but, not an if, not a hey, hold on a second here, we need to talk this through. Not a you're just new to the scene, not you don't understand, you haven't been. He just humbled himself. How do God's people live as free? In humility. If there's nothing else we learn from this story, it should be that. That's what it looks like for God's people to live as free people led by His Spirit. We live as people who have clothed ourselves with humility. A few verses later, God will speak through Moses and remind the people that they are a treasured possession, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Paul will pick up on that exact language in 1 Peter chapter 2. And he will say this to us. This isn't just a 2,000-year-old thing. This is to followers of Jesus. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood. You are a holy nation. You are a people for His own possession. I think that means if He's chosen us and called us and we are His, He's going to protect us. That you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness and into His marvelous light. How do you relate to people who are different? Oh, you just proclaim the excellencies of the One who called you. He goes on in that passage and says this, I urge you as sojourners and exiles, abstain from the passions of the flesh. Keep your conduct honorable, so that when they speak against you, even if they recall you evildoers, one day when Christ comes, they will have seen your good deeds and glorify God your Father. Let's pray. Father, we want to be a people like that, that would glorify you through our lives, through our actions, through our words. Help us as a church family, help us as followers of Jesus to trust that you are the One to protect us, to trust that we have the freedom to proclaim the good news and that you will honor that, and to trust that as we humble ourselves and live in such a way that you would be pleased and glorified. Thank you for the joy of following Jesus Christ. In whose name we pray. Amen.